My name is Amy Bartholow, and I represent Mr. Smith in this appeal. There's a lot going on in this case, and I think I'd like to start off the bat by saying that I would concede that the issue about the burglary of the post office probably needs to be, there wasn't sufficient evidence in the record given the state's brief and the federal statute as to when the post office was leased by the federal government to the state, or vice versa. So I would concede that, that issue need not be addressed in this case. It's probably an issue for the post-conviction or a habeas. As to the stealings, I've also filed a motion to remand to the trial court for resentencing because while this was pending, the decision in State versus Basil came down, which I think now makes clear that Mr. Smith's stealing convictions are now misdemeanors and not felonies, or were all along, but it has been determined. So I'm asking the court to remand those cases for resentencing because I don't think that the question of the lesser included offenses is necessarily relevant now after Basil, that a remand is necessary.
And we ordered it taken with the case because of the timing of it and the fact that it was set for argument today.
Okay.
So that still leaves what counts that are at issue?
So we're still talking about counts 1, 3, 6, and 9, which are all burglary counts. Count 1 is the only first-degree burglary count. The remaining are burglary second. But in each of those counts, the error, which the state again has conceded, was in failing to give the trespass first instruction as well. So I'd like to focus first on count one, which is the jury was instructed on burglary first, which is knowingly entered unlawfully in a structure for the purpose of committing stealing therein, and while in the immediate flight from the structure, he was armed with a weapon. That's because a weapon was taken from inside. He didn't enter with a weapon. It was stolen once he got inside. The jury did obviously find him guilty of stealing that weapon. The burglary second instruction was given, which just withdrew the immediate flight with a gun part. But the judge refused to give trespass first, which is that he solely knowingly entered unlawfully into the structure, but would have withheld for the purpose of committing stealing therein. And similarly, in counts 3, 6, and 9, the only difference between the burglary second and trespass first instructions was that the trespass first left out that he entered with the purpose of committing stealing therein. And our argument is pretty straightforward under Jackson and Pierce. That instruction, whether or not Mr. Smith entered those structures with the purpose of stealing was something only the jury could resolve. And so without the trespass first instruction, there was no way for them to indicate one way or the other that if they didn't believe that he entered with the purpose to steal, that he was just trespassing, and then while he was inside, he decided to take something. Without that instruction, there was no way to test that element, and it's a truly nested lesser because it only varies on that element. The differential element was only the defendant's mental state, whether he knowingly entered unlawfully with the purpose to steal. The state's argument is that because they convicted him of stealing, that we know that he entered with the purpose to steal. But I don't think those two logically follow. Simply because they found that he stole something once inside doesn't inform us about what his mental state was at the point of entry. Really, the only difference, I think the prejudice is pretty clear in counts 3, 6, and 9. The only question is in count 1, whether the burglary second, as in the Frost situation, whether the jury by rejecting burglary, or not going down to burglary second, then would have not further gone down to trespass. But I think the main issue there is that both burglary first and burglary second, the only different element in those two is the weapon. Neither one of them test whether or not Mr. Smith entered with the purpose of committing stealing therein. Only the trespass instruction did that. So the burglary second instruction didn't test the jury's resolve on Mr. Smith's mental state in entering the structure. The state also cites that the recent case of Zatina Torres, but in that case, on the issue of prejudice, for the proposition that reversal is only warranted when the instructional error is so prejudicial that it deprived the defendant of a fair trial. But the difference in Zatina Torres is that there, the jury, it was misinstructed. And the instruction was given, but the question was whether it misled or confused the jury. And I think that's a wholly separate question from whether an instruction was withheld altogether. So I don't think the Zatina Torres analysis of prejudice would apply here. If the court has no other questions.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court?
Certainly.
So the issue of whether the stealing offenses are felonies has been raised in a motion to remand, citing the court's recent decision in Bazell. In Bazell, the court held that stealing offenses based on stealing a handgun were misdemeanors because the subsection 3 subsection did not apply to the offense of stealing because stealing didn't have value as an element. The difference between stealing a handgun and there was, as I recall, one of the counts in this case, count 2, was based on stealing a handgun. The other counts, count 4, count 7, and count 10, were all based on stealing property worth $500, but less than $25,000. The state's position would be that in those instances where value is specifically a specific monetary value is listed, makes that an element of the offense. The holding of Zell would not govern the stealing convictions on those particular counts.
And where is it made now? Does it matter if the statute makes it an element of the offense?
I think it is made an element in subsection 3 of the statute, where it says that the value of the property or services appropriated is $500 or more, but less than $25,000.
And was it submitted for the jury to find it was within that range or over $500?
It was. In those three counts, it was submitted as $500 or more. So the issue would remain live as to whether the trial court erred in not instructing the jury on the included misdemeanor offense of stealing. I think that the parties have pretty well hashed out the position on where they stand on prejudice. As to the burglary counts, there are four burglary counts. One of them is a two-down situation, count one. The others are all one down, because it was burglary in second degree and a failure to submit trespass. With regard to the first count, the court submitted burglary in the first degree, burglary in the second degree, which was without the gun upon leaving, and refused trespass in the first degree. And I think that for various reasons set forth in our brief, that there was no prejudice from failing to submit trespass in that situation. Not solely because the jury had an option, a middle option in that case, and didn't take it, but also because the jury, counts 1 through 4 were all based on a series of events that took place at a single property, where the defendant cut the fence, entered into the property, and then broke into a camper inside of the property, and you know, broke the window out, and then entered, and stole items from inside the camper. There were two burglary counts, so you know, he also broke into an office. He stole items from inside the office, he stole items from inside the camper, and he damaged property in entering onto the property by cutting the fence and by breaking the window in the camper. And under the circumstances of the case, not only is the burglary on count one, that the jury had an option to go down if they wanted to, they didn't. But they also found the defendant guilty of the associated stealing. They also found the defendant guilty of the contemporaneous burglary that took place on that property, and also the associated stealing with the other burglary. To suggest under the facts of this case, and in light of all four verdicts on counts 1 through 4, that there's any unreliability in the jury's verdict and the jury's finding that he entered with the intent to steal, I think is contrary to the facts of the case, and also the other instructions preclude that finding. The jury's verdict communicated that they believed beyond a reasonable doubt that it was his purpose when he entered to commit stealing. That is communication to the jury that's entitled to some credit. If the jury had not been convinced of that, at least as count one, they could have gone down, or they could have acquitted, which was always an option on all of these counts, because the option to acquit generally tests the jury's resolve on all counts. The jury's resolve is further tested as count one because there was a middle option that it could have gone down to. But if you look at the remainder of the facts and the jury's findings of guilt on those four counts, the possibility of prejudice on count one is negated.
Are you arguing that in a sense, the stealing instruction operates as the alternative that was missing in Jackson? If they didn't feel that he had entered unlawfully, they weren't faced with the choice of acquittal or conviction of a crime they didn't believe had been committed. They had a middle option of stealing and took it. Is that your argument?
That's part of my argument, Your Honor. It acts as a proxy, in a way, of providing an additional third option. As to count one, they already had one third option, which was burglary in the second degree. If they had not been convinced of burglary at all, but they'd still harbored, and they'd harbored doubts about that, they could have found him guilty of stealing alone. And so they did have that option. Now, it was an option that was outside of count one because it was submitted in count two, but it does present them an additional option that is separate from simply acquitting and letting him walk out the door. Because if they harbored doubts about the burglary at all, they still could have found him guilty of stealing. So if you look at those four counts together, yes, I think that the jury had before it multiple options and multiple ways to come down off of the greater offenses if the jury had harbored doubts or concerns about the defendant's guilt. But they didn't. They found him guilty of all of those offenses. The burglary, and I think that the evidence with regard to the burglaries at the other two places, one was the Sedalia Tool and Manufacturing, and one was Mr. Crank's shop, also showed that the defendant, if you look at the evidence, the defendant committed property damage, a great degree of property damage at the Sedalia Manufacturing to gain entry. And there was no evidence. I mean, certainly the jury didn't have to believe that his purpose to steal. So that I can see that the jury, that the court should have submitted the instruction. But a review of the evidence in that case indicates that he damaged the property to get in. The jury had before it a charge of property damage. The jury had before it charges of stealing. The jury had before it the charge of burglary. And it found him guilty of all of those things. And there was no contrary evidence to suggest, for instance, that he merely entered to trespass without any illegal purpose to commit stealing. And it was after hours, it was night, it was You know, all those circumstances that support an inference that he was a burglar and not somebody who was merely walking onto the property.
But isn't that contrary to the holding of Jackson and Pierce that they can disbelieve any of the evidence?
If I were arguing that it was not error on that basis, that would be contrary to Jackson. I think it was error not to give it, because the jury didn't have to believe any of that evidence. They didn't have to. And to clarify, my argument is not, and I hope I have not suggested in any way, that you don't need to give the instruction. I think that the court should have given the instruction upon request. But the argument is that there's a separate analysis for prejudice. And if you look at all the facts and circumstances of the case, and if you look at the jury's verdicts, particularly collectively when there are multiple verdicts, and the jury is finding both that he, you know, committed the property damage, that he committed the burglary, and that he committed the stealing that was, that was the purpose, that there's no reasonable probability that if trespass alone had been submitted, the jury would have said, you know what, in fact, I don't think he had that purpose to commit the stealing. I think his purpose really was just to enter unlawfully.
So you're saying that we shouldn't just presume prejudice, that we have to go through this analysis to see if there's a reasonable probability. Is there any authority for that, for us to go through a reasonable probability analysis?
Well, I think that I did cite the Zatina Torres case, which was a case where this court looked at instructional error in that case and included that language about a reasonable probability. And in Jackson, the court also cited reasonable probability language, but ultimately concluded in Jackson that it would presume prejudice under those circumstances, as the court had done in the past. So I think that there are two lines of cases. There are multiple ways that instructional error has been dealt with. I'm asking the court to adopt a rule that says that the court will judicially, well, the court's already adopted a rule, 2802.
But opposing counsel points out the other cases talk about errors in the instructions, not the failure to give a necessary instruction.
Well, and I think that the rule 2802 speaks to both. I think if there's error in failing to give an instruction, the prejudicial effect of that error should be judicially determined under rule 2802F. Now, I agree. The court could say that, when we judicially determine, taking into account presumptions is within the prerogative of the court. And it is. If the court wants to make the presumption part of its judicial determination of prejudice, then it certainly can. But the state's position is that the court should instead focus on the fairness of the defendant's trial and whether there's a real probability that the defendant was deprived of a fair trial and whether there would have been a different verdict in the case. There is rarely a case that comes through our system that is absolutely 100% free of error. But there are lots of cases that are affirmed because we have a certain degree of confidence in a verdict based on the instructions that are given. Here there wasn't an erroneous instruction. The jury's deliberations weren't, misguided.
Are you limiting your argument, or are you saying you don't think that Jackson found there was a presumption of prejudice, or you want us to re-examine Jackson?
I think that I'm asking the court not to simply apply a presumption as the court did in Jackson.
Okay, so yes. you are asking the court to overrule that holding in Jackson.
That aspect of the case where the court presumed prejudice, yes. I think the court should look instead to Rule 2802 and interpret that to mean that the court will look at the facts and circumstances of the case and judicially determine whether there was prejudice from the omitted instruction.
And who will have the burden on that question?
Well, ordinarily, if it's a preserved error, then the state is going to have to show that there wasn't prejudice from that. Actually, that's not what the case law says.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that's...
That isn't what the case law says. The case law says that,
The case law suggests if an instruction, giving any instruction that doesn't comport with MAICR, that there is a presumption of prejudice. And the reason is because we presume they follow the instructions.
Right.
So if the instruction is wrong, the presumption is there's prejudice.
That's right, Your Honor. There is case law that says that. And I think that flows from the presumption that in, where an instruction is actually improperly drafted and the words of the instruction are wrong, we're going to presume that the jury followed those words and was misdirected down a wrong course.
Well, and the same rule applies to failure to give. I mean, 2802 says the giving or the failure to give an instruction in accordance with the rules and the notes on use.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And here's the thing. Failure to give an instruction is error. Now, the question is, the instruction that was given to the jury wasn't erroneous in itself. And the jury went through its deliberations and found beyond a reasonable doubt each and every proposition contained in that instruction. So if the jury had been given another option, it's possible, under Beck versus Alabama, if we indulge the possibility that they were harboring doubts and that they didn't follow the instruction as written, that they might have entered a conviction on the lesser had it been submitted. This isn't a case where the instruction that was submitted misdirected the jury. The instruction that was submitted was right, and it properly set forth the elements, and the jury found those beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I think that in a case like this, where we're not talking about misdirection contained inside of instruction, we wouldn't necessarily presume that the jury was misdirected. We would presume that the jury properly followed the instruction.
Okay. Oh, in the ordinary case, you requested an instruction, it's denied, the error is preserved, it is error, and the appellant would have the burden of proving prejudice.
You're right, Your Honor, and I meant to come back
to that. So what if Jackson said, in the case where there's no lesser given, if we put the burden on the appellant to show prejudice, there will never be any because the state will always have the argument that because they convicted and presumed to have followed the law, that they believed all of the elements were proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore Jackson moved the burden over to the state.
And that's not my intention, first of all, to say that the state will always win. And I think the court could if it wanted to. You're right, the appellant would normally carry the burden to show prejudice. I was thinking for a moment about claims where the state carries a burden of showing harmless error, which was discussed earlier, but the appellant would have that burden. But the court could, for instance, say, you know, it's up to the court, obviously. The court, for instance, could say there's a presumption of prejudice, but it can be rebutted if the state can show that it was rebutted under the facts of the case. Or the court could put the burden on the defendant, as is done in the ordinary course. And that's not to say that the state would always be able to win by saying, well, we know what the jury found, so no harm, no foul. Because this court's precedence and the United States Supreme Court precedent, Beck versus Alabama, has recognized that at least on direct appeal, courts are cognizant of and willing to take into account the possibility that the jury may have harbored doubts. And I'm willing to acknowledge that as a proposition in any given case. But that doesn't mean that a verdict should always be ignored, or that it should be ignored, particularly in light of the evidence that's presented in the case.
Well, there's no discussion in Jackson about a constitutional violation.
That's right.
A constitutional requirement.
In fact, it was decided solely on the basis of the statutory language, and the court pointed out that the defendant had not raised a constitutional challenge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What's wrong with his argument that the stealing charge is irrelevant in determining whether there was error, but that it does shed some light on the question of prejudice in that they were not faced with the choice of convicting him of burglary or walking him?
Because the stealing doesn't test the differential element at all. The stealing only asks whether he had the intent to steal at the time he took property. At that time, he was already inside the structure. The question in the burglary is whether he had that intent to steal when he entered the building. The jury didn't get to determine that at all.
Well,
so it doesn't really inform, it doesn't inform us on the question of the defendant's intent at the time he entered the structure. It only tells us that at some point after he was inside, he decided to steal something.
Well,
they can convict of trespass first and stealing.
The weakest part of your argument is that they didn't have to decide whether he had the intent to steal when he entered. And of course they do. That's the principal feature of the burglary instruction. what you're saying is they didn't have an option on that question, and there, and that shows prejudice.
I think the,
and he's saying, well, there wasn't exactly an option on that question, but they weren't faced with the choice they were faced with in Jackson, which was all or nothing.
Well, but in Jackson, the jury found him guilty of armed criminal action, and that didn't inform whether or not he possessed a weapon. So I think it's the same exact analysis here. The stealing doesn't inform his intent on whether he entered the property with, you know, with an intent to steal.
But to convict a burglary, they had to find an intent to commit a crime. When you enter the building.
Correct.
And you're saying they failed to give trespass, which would have said he just entered illegally but formed the intent later, and that could cover then, and then he could be convicted of stealing.
Right.
But and so that follows under our analysis, but I think this steps back one and says, okay, the U.S. Supreme Court cases like Becker are worried that the jury, if they think he did something, won't have an option. But here, if you submit stealing too, then there is another option, even if it's not a nested option.
Well, and also,
does it matter that it's, whether it's nested in the sense, and so it tests the elements, or does it just have to be another option? That,
no, I think it has to test the elements under Jackson and Pierce. I think there, if there was, and I think this is a nested lesser offense. Trespass is.
Yeah, but the stealing is not nested, but didn't it test? Whether, but if they thought he broke in and only formed the intent to steal later, why couldn't they have acquitted of burglary and convicted of stealing?
But what? And that's that tested that absolutely tested it.
What did it test? It didn't test what his intent was at the time he entered the building.
Well, it did, because if he didn't intend to steal when he intent came in, they just would have convicted him of stealing.
And then that
under your set of facts, oh, he just woke up his mind there. Well, if that's what they believe, they would have found him guilty of stealing and not guilty of burglary.
It doesn't follow the Jackson thing, but
it's not a lesser included.
Yeah, I know, but step back with this, if you would. The reason
doesn't this point out why there is a different analysis between whether there's error and whether there's prejudice?
Well, I still think on the issue of prejudice, you're still substituting the court's determination of the strength of the evidence on a prejudice analysis, where when prejudice is presumed because that question is solely for the jury.
Well, I want you to know that I'm willing to accept your argument that if we decide that that there's a presumption of prejudice, that that's a judicial determination of where to move the burden, okay, which could comply with 2802. But what I don't understand is, in this case, since they did convict him of stealing and burglary, why that didn't really test everything sufficiently to demonstrate that they have rebutted a presumption of prejudice. Because in this case, if he just intended to steal once he got there, that's what they would have convicted him of. I don't have to substitute my fact-finding ability. I can rely on their fact-finding ability to demonstrate in this case that your version, which suggests it's wrong, isn't possible, because they did determine not only that he stole, but that he unlawfully entered with the purpose to steal.
But they didn't determine that because they weren't given the option to say that he didn't unlawfully enter with the purpose to steal.
Well, and I suggest that they did, because they found that he stole, and that in addition to that, that if we presume they followed the instructions, right? That
we presume they followed the instructions, but the converse itself says that you have to find that he, if you have a reasonable doubt as to whether he did so for the purpose of committing stealing therein, you must find him not guilty of burglary second. So if you're going to give the converse, that's exactly the trespass first instruction. And so the jury didn't have an option to tell us what they...
We understand, if there had been no stealing instruction and there had been a failure to give the trespass instruction, then your argument that there's no testing of it. But our question is a little bit different. It's saying, does it have to be tested by another lesser-included nested offense, or can't it, in some circumstances, be tested by a different instruction for a different crime that goes to... Because then that addresses the concern in the U.S. Supreme Court cases about giving the jury a third option.
But it doesn't give them the third option in the context of when he entered the building. It could have been formed much later. So the jury didn't have the option of convicting him of trespass and stealing. They could have done both.
I understand.
So I would ask for a remand on all the burglary convictions and also the misdemeanors. If this court doesn't remand, I think it should remand on the instructional issue for the misdemeanor stealings and let the trial court decide whether Basil applies.
Can you briefly address the argument made by opposing counsel that it doesn't apply to those that the statute says it's a Class C felony if you steal items worth $2,500 and $2,500, and that's what three of the counts were, and that's what was submitted to the jury.
But I think it's all part of the elements of the statute include that. And so
the problem was that the beginning of the statute limited it to cases, to circumstances where the value was an element of the offense, and in these cases it is.
Well, and I guess I would ask for the court if we could do further briefing on that, if this court is going to consider the Basil question here, because there's a case out of the Western District that recently, just last week, found that those issues do apply. So that case may be transferred up to this case. I'm not sure. We haven't done full briefing on the question. So if the court doesn't remand and allow the trial court to make that determination in the first instance, then I would request further briefing on that issue.
I want to make sure I understand. If we thought that the only thing wrong with the stealing counts was the sentencing, was the Basil problem, but we thought the burglary counts needed to be retried because of the instructions, you would be satisfied if we remanded for retrial of the burglary counts but for sentencing on the stealing counts? Or should they all be retried?
Well, I think initially I think they all need to be retried, but I think the trial court will determine after Basil that that the stealing counts are actually misdemeanors, that they couldn't submit an instruction on the felony. So I think it's probably.
And there's no lesser under the misdemeanor either.
Right.
That's the bottom.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.